about that? Basically, what happens according to the police reports I read is that he was walking to school and never made it to school.
Do you have your own impression as to whether he's ever likely to come back or not? If you had to kind of put money on it, you know, at the farm, as they say.
I'd like to hope so.
Yeah, but that's not what I asked. We all like to hope so, right?
I don't think I'd take the bet, because I just don't know. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, it's just a level. I just can't.
Hello, welcome to Killer Cross Space. This is episode 48. This is about Nathaniel Barjona. But he was born as David Paul. He was born on February 15, 1957 in Massachusetts. Like I said, he is known as Nathaniel Barjona. But I'll refer to him as Nathaniel in this episode. And the weirdness started early with Nathaniel, and it would be stated at the age of 6, he would pick his calves until his skin festered. He would then suck the blood from the wound. He would do this at school, causing his mother to get a bunch of phone calls about this act disturbing other kids and teachers. His first crime was reported at a very young age of 7. The crime would be of him talking a 5-year-old girl into his basement. He would tell her he got an Ouija board for his birthday, and it could predict the future. Once they were in the basement, he would try to strangle her, but her screams would be heard by his mother. She would come downstairs to see what was going on and causing her, you know, to stop this incident. But from my understanding, Nathan got little punishment or none. 6 years later, 1970, at the age of 13, he would talk a young 6-year-old boy to come sledding with him in a nearby hill in the area. Nathaniel would end up sexually assaulting the boy. A couple years later, he would try to get 2 boys to a cemetery. I'm not sure if he was going to kill them or molest them, most likely molest them. But one of the boys would feel weird about the situation, and he would end up talking to his friend not to go in either. In March 1985, while being a senior in high school, he would pretend to be a police officer and abduct an 8-year-old boy while he was on his way to school. He would rape and strangle the boy in the car. Somebody in the area would see the abduction and called police. From my understanding, the police would search the area for his car, and they would find it in a parking lot, and his car would be sitting away from, you know, all the other cars. And the boy was found in the car bloody and almost dead, and Nathaniel would be arrested and only sentenced to probation. A few days before graduation, he drove to Hartford, Connecticut, where he would pretend to be a cop again. But this time, he would pick up a 9-year-old girl, and he would assault her in the car, but once she started convulsing and vomiting, he'd throw her out on the sidewalk. Luckily, somebody would witness this and get his license plate tag. This would lead to his arrest. Sadly, though, this incident never got back to his probation officer, and he'd be released from parole in 1976 after his earlier incident in 1985 with the 8-year-old boy. After his release, he'd receive a letter that thanked him for his cooperation. In 1977, in September, Nathaniel would claim to be an undercover FBI agent, and he would convince 2 boys coming out of a theater in Massachusetts to get in his car. He'd drive them to a secluded area where he had set up a tent at. It was reported that he would handcuff, strangle, and flick cigarette ashes onto the boys. Eventually, he would repeat jumping up and down on one of the boys' chest. And one thing about, you know, Nathaniel, he was a pretty big guy. And they said he usually weighed, you know, anywhere from 300 to 375, I've seen. There might have been sometimes he might have been smaller than that, but, you know, he was still a bigger set guy. But he left the one boy behind because he thought he had killed him. And the other boy was placed in his trunk. The boy would not die, though, and once he came back and, you know, from being unconscious, he would get help, which led to Nathaniel's arrest. And the other boy would still be alive in the trunk of the car. And this incident would actually give Nathaniel some time in prison because he'd get convicted of attempted murder and received a sentence of 18 to 20 years.
You serve time for treatment of sexual offenders in a maximum security facility. What was that for?
That was for attempted murder.
Uh-huh. What happened exactly?
I'm not going to get into it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's long gone in the past.
And his first run-in with trouble after being released from the hospital would be in August 1991. Sadly, it was only like a month after his release. And in this incident, he would monitor a 7-year-old boy sitting in a car alone at the post office. But he would enter the car and try setting on the boy, which is so odd to do, you know, definitely in public. Luckily, there were a few witnesses, including the boy's mother, to witness this weird incident. I'm assuming from what I read, it was like when she ran out, you know, when she came outside, you know, she saw that and like ran to the car and all that. But Nathaniel would run away from the scene, and the officer would figure out who the individual was from the description he got from the witnesses. And Nathaniel would be arrested, and he'd claim he got in the car to get out of the rain. Like, who does this, honestly? Like, I'm just kind of like, what kind of excuse is that? You know, like, I just want to get out of the rain. I thought I'd sit in this car instead of this boy. But he would add, though, that he was going to ask for a ride home once the driver came back. And this attack would only result in probation because he agreed to relocate in Montana to live with his mother.
You've been in Montana how many years?
Probably about 15 years.
Mm. You and your mom came. Is she still living?
No, my mom did not come out here.
No?
When I came out here by myself.
Why did you move to Montana?
I was tired of Massachusetts.
Was Massachusetts getting tired of you?
Probably. I mean, it just... there was so much taxes. I mean, I wanted to change.
February 6, 1996, a young boy to the age of 10 years old would disappear that morning on his way to school. That boy was named Zach Ramsey. The reason I'm mentioning him in this episode is because Nathaniel is a suspect in Zach's case. And now I'll go to the story of Zach. Zach would disappear in an alley while walking to school, just like I stated, you know, just a minute ago, going to school. But this morning, a man was sitting in an off-white four-door sedan and was sitting there with his car idling. Did Zach not notice him? Nobody knows for sure because most people felt that Zach might have hurried up his pace or took a different route altogether. One thing that is known for sure is Zach never made it to school that day. His mother would receive a phone call at her work around 10 a.m., She wasn't sure what to make of it at first and thought maybe he had ended up skipping school. I'm going to say this real quick. The beginning audio clip at the beginning of this episode, that is him talking about Zach. This, you know, when they interviewed him, that was in 2006. So, but going back to the story, his mother would go home. No Zach. She went to the school to figure out what was going on. She ended up walking Zach's normal route to the school while calling out his name. Still no Zach. She'd call the police and notified them that her boy was missing. She would tell them that he wasn't a shy boy, enjoyed talking to people, but he was still taught to never get in a car with a stranger he did not know. She let them know he didn't run away the previous month, but it was only for an hour, and he had called from a restaurant so she could come and get him. The police would agree he probably just disappeared because nobody, not even his friends, had seen him. At the time of his disappearance, he was a mixed child. His father is black and his mother is white. He had a dark complexion with dark hair and brown eyes. He wore glasses, but that day he forgot them at his house. He was around 4 feet and about 100 pounds, and he had a small scar on his forehead between his eyebrows. He had blotchy skin and had dimples, and he was wearing a stonewashed jeans, a football jersey with the name Ramsey on the back, and black high-top tennis shoes and a blue denim jacket with green sleeves. When the search of the town would come up with nothing, sadly, and Zach was not located. Some interesting information, though, came out of the door-to-door search because police would learn about a car being seen in the area. One tip that was learned was that this car almost hit Zach. Another witness would see him, and this time, a man following him. Who is this man? The only problem, really, with these tips was a time frame, but those could probably be explained easily. And it was told as well that it was appeared Zach was crying and the man seemed to be upset. Which, you know, if he just about got hit by a car, could be why he was crying. The man was upset because he about just hit the kid with the car. But the lead investigator of the case knew who abducted Zach. His gut feeling told him it was Nathaniel because of his history. Plus, he had a run-in with him back in 1993, only a few days before Christmas, which is kind of the history he knew about. But he was investigating a sexual assault case on an 8-year-old boy. The boy said Nathaniel had fondled him. Nathaniel was his babysitter at the time. Crazy how this guy could become a babysitter. Like, just crazy. But Nathaniel said he didn't do it, so it was, you know, his word against the young boy's word. And the thing that stuck with the detective, though, was Nathaniel's words that if he had done what he was being accused of, he would have killed the boy. The whole case, though, would be dropped roughly 3 years later. Concerning, you know, the 8-year-old boy back in 93. So this would have been dropped roughly in 96. But the detective would say he went to Nathaniel's house after Zach turned up missing. He would state Nathaniel wasn't home, but the house was dark. He would say about how Nathaniel had stuck out in his mind because, like I said a minute ago, the history of Nathaniel, he knew he was violent and still active on the streets. He would send two officers sometime over to talk to Nathaniel later on, but no answer at his home. They'd leave a card, but Nathaniel would never return their phone call. And by the time they reached out to him again, he had got a lawyer and wouldn't talk to the police. And since he moved to Montana, like I said, where he said he moved, you know, with his mother, Nathaniel didn't register as a sex offender, so he was able to be active for 3 more years after Zach's disappearance in 96. But like I said, I'm not sure when he actually moved to Montana. I'm trying to think when he actually got out. It would have been roughly not too long before that. Like I said, since he didn't label, but the cops looked at other people who were known as offenders in the area, even though the lead detective still felt Nathaniel. And an interesting twist gets tossed into Zach's story, which was a truck driver who was a sex offender would mention to a customs agent on the Montana and Canadian border that it turned out to be a lie, though, but he would basically confess to kidnapping and murdering Zach. But this incident would occur a few weeks after Zach had disappeared. Going back to Nathaniel, though, there were some major connections that linked him to the crime. But he worked in the area of Zach's home and school, and he'd shoveled snow off the apartment parking lot. And he attended the same church at times. And supposedly Nathaniel had even asked about Zach days before he disappeared. And the key thing about Nathaniel was he would drive his mom's car. And it was an off-white collar car that fit the description of the car seen in the alley. None of this would help get a search warrant, though. But on the morning of December 13th, 1999, a detective was driving to work when he passed Nathaniel walking near an elementary school. He recognized Nathaniel, and he felt it was weird because he had seen Nathaniel in the same area twice the previous week. He would contact his dispatcher to get a patrol unit to check Nathaniel out. Well, two officers would arrive on scene rather quickly, and one of them would shine their car spotlight on him, and it would reveal that he was in a dark blue jacket that looked like a jacket an officer would wear, and he had a hat on. I believe the hat was a matching, like, a dark blue color as well. And he would keep his hands in his pocket, even though one of the officers had asked him to take his hands out of his pocket on two separate occasions. And they'd ask him if he had anything on him, and he'd tell them after a moment that he was carrying a stun gun.
I don't know how many volts it was a cheap stun gun that I had for protection.
Protection against who?
Anyone that decided to mug me or whatever.
But had you also been dressed and had the stun gun in a way that could make somebody think that you could have been a public servant?
I wore a jacket that looked like a cop's jacket, but it had no insignias, it had no badge.
So it wouldn't have fooled the policeman, in other words?
I don't know if it would fool the cop or not.
Think you could have fooled me?
I don't know.
But the officers would pat him down to find two cans of pepper spray, a toy gun, and a badge. They'd be told to release him at the time, but the next day, lead detective on Zach's case would talk to an attorney's office, and they decided to charge Nathaniel with impersonating a police officer and carrying a concealed weapon, even though that weapon was, I guess, the stun gun. But on December 15th, 1999, a search warrant would get approved to search for the following items like he was wearing near the elementary school. I'm not sure when Nathaniel was moved, but from research, it seems he moved at least two times for sure after he moved to his mother's house in 96, after coming from Massachusetts. And at the time of this search, he lived in an apartment. Once the search was done, the police would find a blue police coat, a silver toy revolver, a badge, a stun gun, a baseball-style hat with security enforcement across the front, two disposable cameras, two albums with cutouts of children inside, another coat with a badge in one of the pockets, more photos and negatives of photos, and a pulley hanging from his kitchen that a rope, cord, or a chain could be connected to, and a document that had described how to tie various knots.
It's my understanding that they found pictures of kids in there.
They found a lot of clippings.
But like I said, he would be charged with impersonating an officer, and once this all went down, another search would take place 2 days later to look for more evidence concerning the photos they had found. In this search, they would find more photos of young children, adults, and stuff attached to a bulletin board, undeveloped film from disposable cameras, 28 boxes containing papers and newspaper clippings, and a list of names of previous victims of Nathaniel. Which some of might not have been victims of Nathaniel, but there was quite a bit, I guess, on the list. But this list mentioned Zachary Ramsey. And not too far from his name would be the word dead.
Had there been clippings of the missing boy?
No.
Stories, like newspaper clippings?
No.
The notebooks were described as pictures of children cut out from annual school books and newspapers with their names underneath. I think one officer even said it's like he was like a collection of baseball cards.
What do you mean, clippings?
Clippings from magazines of various things. I mean, Christmas scenes, kids, adults, people in Halloween costumes. But it wasn't just kids like they implied.
But there were some of kids.
Well, yeah.
And some of the names listed were of several boys from Massachusetts. Three were the ones Nathaniel had abducted in the 70s. I'm assuming it's the ones that I mentioned earlier. But it was estimated to be about 3,500 photos found. And once the detective developed the film, he would find Nathaniel and pictures of a few boys in various states of being undressed. Like, I think there's some of, like, Nathaniel naked on his bed and all that fun stuff. That's not really fun, it's more disturbing. But to take this nightmare even further, they would find letters written by Nathaniel describing food dishes like Little Stew Boy, or Little Boy Stew, Little Boy Pot Pie, lunches served on the patio with a roasted child, and barbecue be some young guy. A sick joke, perhaps? The detectives felt it was a recipe that Nathaniel might have served to his mother, neighbors, and friends during cookouts, and they said he did have a cookout after Zach's disappearance, and he would make various meals involved with meat, and I'm guessing some of the people that attended these cookouts would claim that the meat had tasted strange, and I guess when they mentioned this to Nathaniel, Nathaniel would just tell them he had went deer hunting and shot a deer. But I guess they kind of looked in on it, and they said he hadn't really made any purchases at grocery stores unless he may have paid with cash and stuff like that. Because I guess he didn't own a gun, and he never hunted. So this is like so this is what the police would find out during the investigation. But there's a strong belief that Nathaniel was a cannibal because back in Massachusetts days when he was locked up, he had told a psychiatrist that he wondered what human flesh would taste like.
What about all the evidence that was found in your apartment? There were thousands of photographs, often of boys. There were recipes. There were things written in code.
I didn't have any coding messages or anything.
The reports mentioned over and over during the Massachusetts years that, in addition, had fantasies and curiosity about what human flesh would taste like.
I never had any interest in any form of cannibalism.
In the psychiatric reports that I read all during the time that we were in Massachusetts, there was talk over and over of your having violent...
Look, I already told you we're not going in that direction. Now, if you're going to keep going that way, I'll just get up and I'll walk out and the guard can take me back to my cell.
But back to 1999, though, the search would bring up a piece of plywood with a large smear on it, and there was evidence it had been scrubbed with bleach numerous times. And it also looked like it had been hit with a sharp object many times as well. Could it have been used as a cutting board? And another thing to add to this was a meat grinder was found, and in this meat grinder, hair would be found inside of it. Later on, it would be reported that the hair belonged to an African-American boy, but it did not match Zach. And another location would be searched where Nathaniel had once lived. They would dig up a portion of the garage, and they would find 21 human bone fragments.
What about the bones that were found underneath your garage?
You make it sound as, you know, I'm just some evil person that wants to do real damage to someone.
And it would later reveal that the bones belonged to a boy between 8 to 13 years old. Sadly, these were not those of Zach Ramsey either. But the DNA also didn't match to the hair found in the meat grinder. Upon finding these bones, though, the detectives wanted to look at the pipes under the house, but it would come with no luck because the owner had replaced the pipes after Nathaniel moved. The reason why? They were constantly getting clogged up. But it was stated that Nathaniel did talk about Zach's disappearance at random times. So I'm not sure what kind of like random times they like mean. They're like, hey, Nathaniel, how's your day? I wonder how that Zach Ramsey's case is going. You know, wonder if they found the boy yet. It could be that, you know, like that random. I'm not sure. But like I said, he would make odd comments too about the boy's case. But an old roommate of Nathaniel's would mention about seeing clothes that match what Zach was wearing at the time of his disappearance. And they would also mention about seeing bloody gloves. And it would show up as well in Nathaniel's notes that two of the names on the list belonged to two boys that lived above him in the apartments they lived in. And the boys would be questioned because they were also in photos from inside Nathaniel's apartment. And the boys would confirm the sexual abuse they suffered from the hands of Nathaniel. And it seems Nathaniel met other victims as well at local churches. And I said earlier in the episode that he had attended the same church at times where Zach had gone to church at. So I'm assuming he might have actually went around the area. This is the only thing I could think of and makes sense. But Nathaniel would be charged with 3 counts of sexual assault, 1 count of aggravated kidnapping, and 1 count of assault with a weapon. He would plead innocent to all the charges.
From where you're sitting, it looks as if you're here under false pretenses. Like they nailed you for something you didn't do.
I'm totally innocent. Of all the charges that they charged me with and the ones I'm convicted on.
During the investigation, the detectives wondered if Nathaniel had done any crimes in Canada since, you know, Montana is close to Canada. And I guess they were able to actually pinpoint that he was in Canada a few times, but nothing would be found. Now, it's still possible that he did do stuff up there. It's just they, you know, at the time, I guess even now they couldn't link him to anything up that way. But you might be able to, you know, dig into some Canada crimes and be able to find out something that might match up with Nathaniel. But the crazy thing is, even though there was evidence against Nathaniel involving Zach's disappearance, Zach's mother would state she did not feel Nathaniel had anything to do with her son's disappearance. She felt her son was still alive, and from my understanding, a psychic would confirm this to her after she had seen a video of a boy in Italy. I'm assuming she thought, you know, the boy in that video was her son. But the police would show her, though, it was not Zach. And from my understanding, Zach would officially be labeled dead sometime in 2011, even though she had protested about it. But going back to her saying she felt Nathaniel innocent, it would basically help Nathaniel not be charged in Zach's disappearance, and it would all be thrown out in court.
She asked me a lot of questions that, did I take her boy and all that stuff? And I said, no. And she says, well, I know what it's like to be falsely accused. And we basically left it at that, and she left.
Okay, I won't go into Nathaniel's trial, but it did last for about a week, and he ended up getting, you know, 10 years for the aggravated kidnapping, 100 years for the sexual assault, 20 years for the felony assault, and he'd have to serve the term at the Montana State Prison. And he would die on April 14, 2008, still claiming he was innocent. Whether you believe he's innocent or not, I personally don't think he is. Like, I know he's a suspected serial killer. I think he, you know, there's a lot of evidence that points to that he's a suspect, though, that he's a serial killer. You know, and it definitely looks like he might have been a cannibal, which is crazy. You know, all the stuff he's done, you know, this dude is a monster. And, you know, at least he did die, you know, over 10 years ago, and he's no longer on this world. But, you know, he caused a lot of pain and grief for a lot of people. And, you know, he'd done it at a young age. But I hadn't really ever heard of him until, if you remember when I covered the Andy story, the boy that disappeared in 1976. His name was brought up on a message board I was reading, and I was got to looking into him. I'm like, well, crap, this guy, you know, he's done a lot, and not many people seem like to really know about him. There's been like a few things, you know, that they've done on him, but it's very possible because, you know, he was born 57. You know, he actually started crimes at 7, and that would have put him 19 when Andy disappeared. So, very interesting, I think. You know, but at least. like I said, at least he died and don't have to worry about that. But, you know, even with his death, it don't really bring back all the stuff that he's done. So, one thing, though, about researching his case, I did find some other possible cases I could be recording on soon. I'm going to hopefully be digging into the research soon on them and see how much I can dig up and put together. But I thank you all for tuning in on this episode, and I'll see you on the next one.